I've had a bit of a varied career. I've been a teacher. I'm also a chartered accountant, and currently I'm working with CAFOD and with Durham University. So it's there's been two projects with CAFOD. The first of them, it has finished now, and I won't talk about it now, but if you have any questions, I can talk a little bit about that. We spoke to lots of partners in the Global South about the current realities of the world. And then we've moved on to a second project, which is really about the title we're using at the moment is the spirituality of encountering catastrophic reality. So it's really about the spiritual resources that are needed to cope with the current situation that we're in today. And then I do that kind of 0.5, and then the other 0.5, I work for a completely different charity where I do finance, but it's a Northeast charity called Your Voice Counts, and we do advocacy and we do community building for people with learning disabilities. So today I do lots of kind of ad hoc stuff for CAFOD as well, and the church in general. As I said in the introduction, I am a deacon as well. So all of this kind of space feels really diaconal, I think it is something else that I would say. So I've been asked today to talk about Laudate Diem, and so my intention was just to give a bit of a summary of the document, and then really just my take on the document, which is by no means definitive, and other people may have a different. So shall I go straight into it, or does anyone want to say anything?
Carry on, Gareth, and we'll take some questions and answers towards the end, I think. That would be good, and sort of get a conversation going with you. So
Yeah.
over to you. That's fine. That's good. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Laudate Diem, I think the first thing to say is it's quite a short document. So the trick with it is to actually read the document itself, because it really doesn't take long. It's kind of an hour's read, something like that. And that in itself, I think, is quite significant. It's been described as an addendum to Laudato Si, rather than as a kind of standalone document. But we'll come on to that in a moment. Just to talk about the document itself, then, it starts off with the global climate crisis, and it describes the current crisis. It describes it in kind of graphic detail, really, where we are at the moment. And it essentially says that the document's being issued because very little has been done, certainly not enough has been done since Laudato Si. Was issued by the Pope a few years ago. So it starts with the reality of the world. I think this is something that Pope Francis has done quite a lot, really, and he does that in a way that previous papal documents haven't done. I would suggest that comes out of the See, Judge, Act tradition, which I associate with Latin America, really. I know that's not where it comes from. It comes from the kind of Catholic youth movement, but it's been kind of adopted, I think, in a lot of Latin American theology, and I think that's influenced Pope Francis quite a lot. So he starts with the reality of the current world. But then the second chapter is called A Growing Technocratic Paradigm. So in this second chapter, he goes straight into the theology, really. It doesn't cut it it's not all about the climate crisis and then the theology at the end. It kind of goes straight into the theology in the second paragraph. Pope Francis talks a lot about the technocratic paradigm. One of the things I like to say about Pope Francis is that he hasn't written the most influential PhD in the world. So he started a PhD in kind of middle age and never wrote it, never finished it. It was on Romano Guardini, a Catholic priest and really very influential person in the early part of the 20th century. Influential not because of what he did, but of the people that he influenced, people like three of the popes, John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and Pope Francis. But this idea of the technocratic paradigm really comes out of that. And lurking behind that is a theologian called Martin Heidegger, and his views on technology. So I can talk about that if anyone's got any questions. So it starts with the climate crisis. It goes into the technocratic paradigm. And Pope Francis's view is essentially that the technocratic paradigm is a bad thing. He's not against technology at all, but he's against what he calls the technocratic paradigm. And I like to think of that being like in the idiom, it's like the tail wagging the dog. We've become obsessed with technology. We've become dependent on technology. Think of it in your own life. I mean, how long is it since you had a mobile phone? But most of us feel now that we can't do without a mobile phone. So there's this sense in which the technology kind of takes over and we become dependent on it. And rather than being a servant of human beings, it becomes a kind of master of human beings. So he then goes into the more description of what's happened recently. He talks about the weakness of international politics, the failure of leaders to deal with the climate crisis. And he then talks through the climate conferences, progress and failures, and what to expect from the next COP in Dubai. So he's very critical about the current leadership of the world in response to the climate crisis. A lot of Pope Francis's stuff is grassroots stuff. It's about it's about empowering people to seek their own solutions. And he's kind of caught slightly on the horns of a dilemma, I think, with this document in that he wants to say that still. He wants to say that the grassroots are really important. What you do, what I do as an individual is really important. But he also has to affirm the fact that actually there's going to need to be political solutions to this. There's going to need to be kind of old-fashioned type dialogue between major powers as well. And then he ends really in what he calls the spiritual motivations. He talks about the future. He talks about what kind of planet we're going to leave for our children. And the kind of the hinge question really is, what's human life for? What's our life for? And how are we going to leave the world in a better state than we found it? So in some ways, quite an odd structure for a papal document. It starts in the current reality, it goes into the theology, then it goes back to the current reality and how we've got here, and it ends in spiritual motivations. Just to kind of contextualize it a bit, I think you have to see it in the wider context of Francis's writing, which you then have to see in the wider context of Catholic social teaching. So if I can have a brief canter for a minute or two through Catholic social teaching, I like to talk about that in three phases. It starts in 1891 with Rerum Novarum, which is on the new things, and the new things are really the Industrial Revolution and the relationship between capital and workers and private property and how workers are treated in industry. So I've called that the intranational phase because it's very much within countries and often it's kind of within businesses as well. How do businesses treat the workers and that relationship between labour and capital, as I've said. That lasts, I would say, really until the Second Vatican Council after the Second World War. So if we think 1967, you get Populorum Progressio, which is on international development. I think that around that time, you get a new stage. So it's no longer intranational, it's international. And it starts thinking about relationships between countries and the responsibilities countries have towards one another. That really lasts till Pope Benedict's document, Caritas in Veritate, in 2009. And then you get Pope Francis, and I think something changes again. He talks about everything being connected. He's constantly saying everything is connected and nobody's saved alone. And he talks about, he uses the word integral a lot. So integral is not a new word with Pope Francis. It's something that's in Catholic social teaching before. But what's he trying to do? He's trying to integrate more things. He's trying to integrate not just human beings, but the rest of creation as well. So I think you have a bit of a widening out during this whole history of Catholic social teaching. It starts within countries. It then looks at international development, so it's human beings across the world, but then it wants to bring in non-human life as well. And we have that widening out. This is very much, this is a Catholic thing, isn't it? This is what Catholic is. It's kind of expansive, and it wants to kind of bring everything within the kind of remit of Catholicism, really. So one of the key documents, as you all know, is Laudato Si, which is taken to be an encyclical on the environment, but it's very much in that tradition. It's widened things out, and it's bringing more things into the debate. That was 2015, 15 or 16, that was out. And the essential thing is that not enough has been done since then, and Francis has been very specific about that. The crisis has deepened, there's been insufficient action taken, and so Laudato Deum comes on the back of that. As I said at the beginning, it's much shorter. It's a call to action. So Laudato Si is an encyclical letter. It's a letter from the Pope to the churches. And really, since the Second Vatican Council, those letters have been addressed to the Catholic faithful, but also to all people of goodwill. But there's still that kind of emphasis on this is to the churches, this is to the Catholic faithful, whereas Laudato Diem is an exhortation. It's a call to action, and again, it's very specifically to all people of goodwill. So it's moved from something expansive and relatively slow to something which is you need to take action and you need to do this now. As a kind of analogy for that, think of sort of like the Old Testament compared to the New Testament. The Old Testament is very big, very expansive, very long. And then you get the Gospels, and it's short, and everything seems to be happening in the moment, and everything moves on quickly. I think that's a good way of seeing the differences between these two documents. It fits in very much with kind of what Pope Francis has tried to do generally. It was issued at the start of the synod process, and I'm sure you all know about the synod, but that's been kind of in consulting the Catholic faithful on where the church is and how the church can move on. And that's very much what Francis likes to do. He likes to speak to the people. His whole kind of spirituality is a bottom-up spirituality, really, rather than a top-down spirituality. So the document feels very different to Laudato Si. It is very much a call to action. It has a sense of urgency. It's less abstract. It's less high level. The other way I kind of think about it is it's like bishops' conference documents. So if you have a read through Bishops' Conference documents in sort of the last 30, 40 years, they used to be kind of quite slow, big, expansive documents that didn't really call for action for people to do things, but they discussed a topic. And as time's moved on, they've become much more issue focused. My favourite example of this, which I quote over and over again, is the bishops of Zimbabwe, and they've put out a series of documents, but it's been the country we want, it's been the economy we want, and they've canvassed the views of all lots of people in the churches. They held big meetings about this, and then they write a document on the back of that. And this feels a bit more like one of these modern bishops' conference documents. It's in response to a specific issue, and it's saying we need to get on with something as quickly as possible. So In other ways, it's different to previous papal documents. This kind of specific engagement with science and politics is it's been creeping in. It's been creeping in really since Benedict, but it's very specific in this document in a way that I haven't seen before in a papal document. I mentioned the technocratic paradigm before. I think that's that kind of ups the ante on things. If you read some of the language in this document, it's almost like a demonic nature of the paradigm. He talks about human beings with no limits. He talks about creation being a slave. He talks of chilling power of the few at the expense of the many. So the language is really ratcheted up in this as well. And I don't think that's just a rhetorical device. I think this is rooted in Romano Guardini and all the work that Francis did in the past. Guardini talks in the end of the modern world about how we've gained mastery over the world through our use of power, our use of technology, but we haven't gained mastery over ourselves. So the kind of chthonic powers, the things that we thought we'd mastered in the world out there are now rising up within ourselves. There's a long perspective in this document. It says about our children paying for our inaction. It talks about structural sin, again, something that's come out of Latin American theology. But we have a structurally sinful situation in climate change. The document says that quite specifically. And the thing about structure is it tends to perpetuate over time and have long-term consequences. So this long-term perspective and bringing in our children is an important part of the document. It talks about multilateralism. Again, this is the horns of the dilemma I talked about before. The modern world has multiple sites of agency. It isn't just I think back to the Cold War when it was kind of two superpowers and nobody else seemed to matter. It's not like that anymore. There's multiple human sites of agency. But what we're increasingly realizing is that there's multiple non-human sites of agency. We are not kind of looking at this as from Bruno Latour. We're not looking out of a bay window at nature as we used to kind of think we were doing. We are part of nature, we are part of the world, and lots of other creatures have agency as well. The document's political. It's more political than I've ever noticed in a papal document before. It has comments like, quote, "It is no longer helpful for us to support institutions in order to preserve the rights of the more powerful without caring for those of all." It doesn't specify what those institutions are, but it's not difficult to see kind of the UN and the COP and so on as part of these institutions. And then, as I've said, it ends in a kind of situated anthropocentrism, as Francis says. It ends with the spiritual motivation. So just to summarize all of that, I think the document is very much in the tradition of Catholic social teaching, which has come from quite small and expanded out over time. It's very much in the vein of what Francis has been trying to do with synodality and with a grassroots bottom-up kind of theology. But it's an odd document in that it's very short, and it really is an exhortation. And I think the shortness of the document, as much as anything, and the strength of the language speaks to where we are really with the climate crisis at the moment. We've run out of time, and I think Francis is trying to tell us that. So I think that's all I want to say. But I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's really interesting. Thanks. We'll take a few questions. Yeah, indeed. Well, I'll get the ball rolling, actually, if I may, Gareth. Normally when we look at Francis and stuff, and I like your analysis of Catholic social teaching, the intra, the international, and now the more expansive interconnectivity, if you like, and I can see that sort of going out, as you say. I was just sort of interested in, you know, as you say, it's a blunt document. The language is pretty blunt. He's pretty fed up, really, that nobody's been listening. You know, nobody's really been taking action. But what I want to sort of get to is the idea of the institutions and government and politics versus what individuals can do and stuff. You know, and you know, he talks about, you know, we're on a pilgrimage of, you know, personal conversion. And that's one of the things that our group, the Northern Diocese group, we've been spending quite a lot of time on, looking at the need for that personal conversion to buy into what's going on. But it seems to me that in this document, really, he's more pointing the finger not at the individual and what the individual can do, which is significant, but more at the institutions of not doing things. And I'm just sort of wondering how, you know, how critical he can be of that sort of thing without losing, you know, losing what he's fought for all this time, you know, to be listened to, if you like. You know, I'm just wondering if there's an issue there about being listened to and not going too far and saying what he said. You know, like, you know, I think he started off by saying something like, with the passage of time, I've realized that our responses have not been adequate whilst the world in which we live is collapsing and maybe near to breaking point. So, you know, not so much who's to blame, but, you know, getting that balance between making issues of things and being listened to by the people that can change things.
Yeah, I like your analysis of the blunt language at the start. Somebody described it as grumpy papa. You do have a sense with Francis that he's grumpier than he used to because nobody's been listening or not enough people have been listening. I think that's one of the kind of most interesting things about the document and potentially one of the more problematic things about the document as well. Actually, though, it's one of the more difficult things about Francis's papacy, and without looking back at this 100 years hence, it's difficult to say where we are at the moment. You see the same thing with the synod. So Francis is a Jesuit. It's all about discernment. It's all about kind of taking a wise approach to things, listening to people, not jumping into action, certainly not ordering people about, not taking a kind of command and control approach to the church and so on, encouraging, bringing things up from the grassroots. I think that's the thing. That's what he does really well, and he's done that throughout his papacy. You read any of it, his documents, and you feel inspired. You feel proud to be a Catholic. You feel proud to be a Christian, but you also feel inspired to actually get off your backside and do something and get involved. So Francis does all of that really well, but nobody's taking action, or not enough people are taking action, or the action that's being taken is not happening fast enough. And there's just a real sense of, for me at least, there's a real sense of that in this document and the kind of frustration. He wants to continue with that approach. He wants to affirm how important your individual action is, your personal conversion to this issue is. But actually, he also realizes that time is short. Some people have a lot of power, and if those people could be galvanized to use that power in a good way, then more could be achieved in a short period of time.
Yeah, thank you. That's really, really good. And I think I'll take away from this meeting certainly the words "grumpy papa." You know. I've been accused of that myself, actually, you know, but I'll go over to Anthony, who's, I hope we can hear you now, Anthony. You want to ask a question? Go ahead. We can't actually hear you there. You're on mute, Anthony. Oh, come off, you're still on mute. Come off your mute again.
Yeah,
that's it. So
you can hear me now.
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's not so much a question as reflections. Listening there to Gareth, and I've tried to write these down in sequence. But let's say Laudato Deum to me was it wasn't just stronger, But I thought the shortness of it emphasised the message that he was trying to get over. And I remember when I read Laudato Si to begin with, that was when I researched the difference between apostolic exhortations and encyclicals. And I think the first one, Laudato Si, was an encyclical as well, wasn't it? I mean, that got comments from all over the place. Now, he hasn't put out a renewal of Evangelii Gaudium, but he has reflected on it. He's put something out, and then he put something out again for the Feast of Christ the King. And that too, it's a very brief statement, but that too is much stronger for being brief, and perhaps sensing his irritation, as Gareth says, about it over the last 9 years, is it, you know, people haven't been listening. So that's my first point. The second point is a very brief one. The Catholic social teaching indeed goes back to Pope Leo. I said to a priest when Evangelii Gaudium was launched that, you know, how good this was. And he just said, well, there's been many Catholic social teaching encyclicals since Pope Leo. So I looked them up and I got a long list. There has been a long list of them. That's the most significant one for me was Gaudium et Spes, which was the unfinished business of Vatican II. So we've had all this stuff before, but no one's heeded it. And even though Pope Francis is putting it over much stronger, people are still not heeding it. Advocacy and leading the world. I suppose that goes into the next point, that the church is not advocating for what it should be. Our Bishop John always advocates for the poor and for the environment in just about any homily that he speaks on. The words are always in there. And the thing I've heard of recently is these three C's. Unfortunately, I can't remember what the three C's are, but I can say what they are. And the first one is about community. The second one is about us having individual charisms. And the third one is about working collectively, bringing all those charisms together in one big exercise in interconnectivity. And I don't think we're even starting with communication. So we've got, that was it. I was reflecting on See, Judge, Act, which is a nice little phrase. But the other nice little phrase is these three C's, whatever those three C's are, there's words to them that I can't actually remember. So last point is the message is very, very clear indeed. The synod too, with the synthesis is coming out with broadly the same things to reflect on. But the people don't listen. They don't hear it from the pulpit. They hear it from Pope Francis. They hear it from Bishop John. But they don't hear it from the pulpit. And until they hear it from the pulpit, they will not change.
Well, let's take that last point then, Anthony, because summed up, it seems to me, you know, there's as much communication and advocacy going on and powerful words from people like Pope Francis that are trickling down or, as you say, bottom up, Gareth. But are people listening? And one of the questions, I guess, is, you know, has the church as clergy, priests, whatever, as opposed to the people, does it have a bit more of a duty to speak out? Or, you know, because it seems to me that the sacramental church doesn't seem to connect too well with the social church, if you like, you know. What do you have a view on that, or, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, speaking as a deacon, just, you know, as yourself.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think as part of the current project we're doing, we have asked that question. We've asked about what's the situation like in your local parish? Are people interested in the climate? Do you talk about that? We've also said, does your priest ever or your deacon ever actually preach about it? And we've asked those kind of questions, and the situation's patchy. But I would say overall, there's more priests not preaching about it than actually preaching about it. So I think there's plenty of work to be done in this area. It's also, I mean, I preach as a deacon, and I find it difficult to preach in a useful way on the environment, on the climate crisis. I don't want it to be like, this is my climate crisis homily, and for that to be different than what I say normally. So you try and bring these things in as part of something else, as part of a homily. So I experience it personally as a difficulty in my own ministry, and certainly the people we've spoken to, the picture out there is that there's not a lot of it happening.
Can I just say, I mean, one of the problems is that the environment is not mentioned at all in the Gospels. And yet, there is a very, very clear link between the environment and what is said in the Gospels. I mean, taking in particular Matthew's Gospel for last Sunday, that was very, very clear indeed. The message we got from the pulpit supported that message, but in a way that was really so general and vague that everybody would walk away from church thinking that they were doing what was being asked, and clearly they're not. I mean, what Pope Francis is saying about Evangelii Gaudium, his revisiting of it, is that salvation and redemption are about living for the poor, living as Jesus did for the poor. That's a very, very strong message, because in the same breath, he's saying that if you don't do this, then you don't go to heaven. So it's a strong message.
It is. As Catholics, we should be comfortable with the development of doctrine. It's one of the things that the Catholic Church does better than the churches of the Reformation. So we shouldn't be worried that the environment isn't specifically talked about in the Gospels, and we should be happy to apply the kind of truths of the faith to the modern situation, which is really what Catholic social teaching does. It looks at whatever the current situation is and then tries to apply the faith to that situation.
Okay, thanks. Thanks. And thanks, Anthony. That's good. Chris, would you like to come in?
Yeah, I just wondered if Gareth could say something about. I mean, Laudato Si had a really, I think, influence on COP21 and the Paris Agreement. And I think it was, I think Pope Francis issued Laudato Si because he was trying to influence world, so the communities, world communities really came together with the Paris Agreement. And of course, there was a lot of hope and expectation that, in a sense, I think perhaps we all thought we're really going to go places now, and countries will follow and implement the Paris Agreement. I sense that Laudato Deum is very much an attempt to influence COP28. And I think perhaps there is a sense that the international community could come together at COP28. So I just wondered if Gareth could perhaps give us a sense of optimism, perhaps that perhaps COP28 can be that moment, and Laudato Deum and Pope Francis could again, have that influence. And of course, I was disappointed yesterday when I realized that Pope Francis isn't going to be able to attend COP28. But so that's my question, really. Can COP28 be this real coming together of countries?
I mean, I would like to say yes to you. That's not my feeling. It is unfortunate that Francis won't be there. If Francis is anything, then he's a great political player. So yeah, absolutely, he will have issued this document. He will have timed it well. Everything Francis does, in some sense, is political, and I think that's one of the reasons why we see him a bit grumpier than he used to be, because he's good at this. He's good at this. He's been good at this throughout his career, and he's kind of reaching the end of his rope, really, I think, with it all, and with the power that he's got. Reading the document, I'm not sure I can remember the line specifically off the top of my head, but he says something about, we have to hope that the next COP is a success, because not to hope that would be suicide. The way he phrased it in the document, which that's probably a really poor paraphrase, but the way he phrased it made me feel as though he didn't feel very hopeful about this either. And I think, again, this is back to the language of the document, the bluntness of the language of the document, the kind of compared to the stuff that he's done in the past. I don't think he did. He does feel particularly hopeful about this. at this stage. Sorry, that wasn't a great answer, was it? I do like to give people
We'll
hope.
keep praying, Carol. We'll keep on praying.
Yeah,
I know.
I think with.
Yeah, just to follow very quickly, I know Christiana Figueres, who was one of the key architects of the Paris Agreement, she's spoken about how powerful the faith communities were in really creating the atmosphere for the Paris Agreement. So I think what Laudato Deum does underline is how important that people of all faiths can actually speak about this and continue to really push for the agreements that we need and the action that we need.
Yeah, we had an interesting conversation with someone who'd been at the last COP and had talked about how, on the face of it was the worst experience in the world. Wherever the hotel was where they made them stay, the planes were kind of overhead all the times, which kind of really reinforced the kind of nature of the modern world. And then she said there was kind of oil industry people everywhere that you looked and trying to shape the conversation and so on. And yet she reported to us as feeling kind of more spiritually alive than she'd ever felt, and more held, I think was her word, than she'd ever felt before. So there was this curious kind of conjunction of very bad things with kind of a kind of sense of spiritual support that she hadn't felt before. And I think we do, as Christians, as Catholics, we do need to remember that the Holy Spirit is still out there and is still active and is still kind of the main player in all of this.
Yeah, good points. I mean, one of the things that everything's that Francis has been trying to do is create this sense of urgency and you know, sort of the environment is a, you know, don't get me wrong when I say this, but it's a sort of slow burn issue, you know, and, you know, you don't have that immediacy that grabs you because the impact is going to creep up on you slowly sort of thing, you know. And so it's a really difficult issue to get that sort of urgency about. OK, anybody else like to come in? Yeah, Justin?
Okay, it's a question I suppose really for you, Gareth. A personal question, if you like. My feeling is that, you know, the idea of things happening within parishes or within organisations is they're often more successful when they come from the bottom up, if you like. You know, from the grassroots. I'm thinking particularly things like Live Simply and so on. But in order for those people to get the message, one of the reasons why I think it's more successful in schools is that they can do that bottom up, but they also have the teaching coming through, you know their curriculum and their RE and so on. So if you think the same for parishes and other things, then okay, it can start with the bottom up, but there has to be that spark, doesn't it? That information first of all, for them to get to that stage. And you mentioned that you personally find it difficult to sort of preach about climate and so on. So what hope is there for other people who don't feel as committed as you, do you think, to preach that? Or what other ways are there of getting the ordinary people in the pews to know and get this conversion?
Yeah, I think from the conversations we've had with people, things can happen in different ways. Sometimes you hear the story that there was a priest who was interested in this and really led the parish, and it was kind of a converted parish because of that. But we hear other stories where it's individuals who've done that, lay people who've done that, and again that it's been kind of transformational for the parish. I think there's a kind of disconnect, isn't there? We've got Pope Francis who's saying all of the right things and is genuinely inspirational, and then we have individuals out there who are taking this up and doing inspirational things, but sometimes the middle bit's missing, and so I guess I mean, I don't have a kind of one size fits all answer for that. What we see various groups. We see Caritas organisations. We see Green Christian. We see CAFOD. We see lots of different groups and individuals trying to operate in this space. As a kind of wider point, the first CAFOD project that's just finished, the kind of journal article that ended up with that was looking in its final section at Catholic social teaching and what that could look like in the future. And I propose kind of three levels of Catholic social teaching. One is the kind of grassroots level where people are doing things and also reflecting on what they're doing. You can talk about that in the kind of Latin American context and sort of talk about base communities and these little small groups. You can talk about that in a parish or a kind of parish environmental group context. So two things are happening. One is that people are taking some sort of action, but also they're reflecting on their action, which has to be theological in some sense. Then you've got the middle section, and there are a number of different kind of organizational actors in the middle section. One is bishops' conferences, and you do get some great examples of bishops' conference documents, but you also get other bishops' conferences, which are periods of times don't say anything helpful for decades, for long periods of times. So you've got the kind of bishops' conference, but then you've got lots of other kind of organizations in that space, organizations like CAFOD, like Caritas, like Green Christian, Christian Aid, and all of these sorts of things. And so they should, in one sense, be leading, but in another sense, be enabling the things that are already happening. And then you've got the kind of top level, which is where people normally start with Catholic social teaching, which is sort of the papal magisterium. And I think what Francis has shown is that the papal magisterium, rather than being a kind of top-down imposition on other people, can actually be subsidiarity at its best. It can be enabling people, it can be inspiring people. So that was a very long answer to without a real answer in there, but there are different levels of Catholic social teaching. There are different levels of within, therefore, within that of both action and theological reflection. And it's a kind of, my view would be that it's a multifarious a melting pot of different things rather than a kind of one size fits all.
That's interesting. If I could just follow up on that point, Gareth, just go back to bishops' conferences and stuff. You mentioned Zimbabwe at the beginning. I followed a few sort of bishops' conferences. Malawi, for example, the overthrow of Hastings Banda was very much engineered by the Catholic bishops of Malawi back in the sort of 70s and 80s and stuff. Uganda, I spent time in Uganda. The bishops put their lives on the line speaking out against injustice, And I'm just sort of wondering, it seems that our bishops' conference is a rather sort of mild, genteel lot that say, when you criticize them, they say to me, Mark, not that they speak to me, of course, but they say, behind closed doors, we can be quite robust. We can be saying things and whatever. And we do that behind closed doors. And my feeling is, well, I wish you'd open the doors and we could hear you a bit because we're not hearing you, being honest about it. So what do you think? Bishops' conferences, are they a bit like the UN at the moment, a bit toothless, so to speak?
I mean, I think it's hard to generalize. Obviously, as a deacon, I have no comment to make at all about the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. But like as I said, by highlighting the Zimbabwean bishops, you get some really good stuff, and you get some genuine leadership. But it's not, you can't just say Bishops' Conference A is always good and Bishops' Conference B is always bad. They go through peaks and troughs. I mean, there was the document whose name now escapes me from the US bishops in the 80s about economics, and that was an absolutely cracking document at the time. And sometimes bishops' conferences seem to say useful things, and sometimes they kind of turn into a gentleman's club.
I'll take back my what I said there. We'll eradicate it from the recording. Stephen, you were going to ask.
Well, a comment really that I've long held that whoever controls the language, controls the argument, and that Pope Francis has given us, he's not just told us what to do, but he's given us the wonderful language to do it. And when I've used the language of Pope Francis, you know, we're talking with, you know, civil environmentalists, that they see things in a different way. And two things that strike me, a word that particularly strikes me in his language is gratitude. And we never hear enough of that, because what our current world has done is replace gratitude with attitude. And if we continue to speak that language, which is very, very rich, then I think that's how we can change people's perceptions. Grassroots stuff, I'm talking, but he speaks so wonderfully.
Yeah.
That's just a thought I leave you with.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. Anybody else want to come in here? Hi, Bernadette.
Hello, sorry I'm late.
That's okay. You're fine. Thanks for joining us as well. Appreciated. And see Pablo's back with us a bit as well. We'll wind up this part of the conversation here. Does anybody else want to come in before we do take a last question? Anthony?
Just reflecting on what everybody said over the last few minutes. Going right back to what Justine was saying and Gareth's response to that, the three areas. What we are doing in our parish of Our Lady of the Valley, we've got a quite a strong Laudato Si group, and we have now developed a very strong link with the school. The school is actually reaching out to the parish more than the parish is reaching out to the school. But that is growing, and we are starting to link it with the community within the parish. We've had a family day which came out of the Laudato Si group. We're talking about more family type of events and events that are parish. There's three churches, about linking those three churches and linking with the schools, the three primary schools as well. So we are trying that grassroots level. At the middle level, I think the Bishops' Conference is pretty good in putting stuff out, but it puts such a lot of other stuff out that it gets buried. And I don't think most people go into the, get the news from the Bishops' Conference. Stephen, gratitude versus attitude. I think perhaps I'm guilty of that in falling into a kind of preaching way of talking, because I feel like Pope Francis feels, but I probably talk negatively rather than positively. And I think I'm going to have to accept that I've got to change that way and perhaps be more encouraging. So, Justine, you can do something from the bottom, even without the information to begin with. But having got that bit, and I think it's the last point that probably came from Stephen, that reading all those words of Pope Francis, I feel like, well, I've heard it before. This is reinforcing, but I've heard it before. But what I do is take key phrases and quote those key phrases, because I think there's some very, very good key phrases in the stuff that is going out from Pope Francis, from the Synod, from a number of places. So that for me is the information that I'm trying to pump into the Laudato Si group.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Anthony. Okay, that's great. Gareth, thanks very much. It's been really, really interesting to get both the sort of insight into the document itself, and also to get the sort of wider perspective of where the document sits in Catholic social teaching and sits in relation to other documents and in relation to where Catholic social teaching has been moving us towards Francis's sort of position on a sort of interconnectivity of everything. So I think all of us will take something from your talk and really, really enjoyed it. And it's been, thank you very much for, sharing that with us and stuff. And I think we'll take a great interest in following up from this meeting. We're going to sort of move on a little bit now to bring